Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1323. Interview with Jim DiAgemio and Paul Blow about chokeholds. This is being recorded on March 8th of the year 2024. And once again, it is my privilege and pleasure to bring back to our airwaves Paul Blow and Jim DiAgemio, two of the major contributors to the new book, JFK Assassination Chokeholds. Both are also familiar to the audience, Jim, as the author of Destiny Betrayed, which we spent 25 one-hour shows of reviewing. And also, both Jim and Paul were involved with JFK Revisited, the long documentary by Oliver Stone, which we also parsed in 27 one-hour segments. Jim, Paul, welcome back to our airwaves.
Nice to be here.
Nice to be here, Dave. Thank you.
And as we contemplate JFK assassination chokeholds, and that is both the title of and the operating concept behind the new book that has been released, again, the JFK assassination chokeholds. And the two of you are contributing, as well as Matt Crumpton, Andrew Ivor, and Mark Adanchik. And there is a long chapter, the longest chapter in this book, which I think really serves as something of an in vitro examination of the JFK assassination and why it is not only still relevant, but why the discussion has remained so limited over the decades. There is an old saying, I think it was coined by Dr. Johnson centuries ago, that it can be truly said that treason doth never succeed, because when it doth succeed, none dare call it treason. And I think it would be fair to say that the JFK assassination was a coup d'etat, and for that reason, no one will say that it is a coup d'etat. And in that long chapter, 60 years of obstruction of justice, I think what has been illustrated there is what the late brilliant political comedian Mark Saul observed, by the way, not incidentally one of Jim Garrison's investigators. He observed that how many lies before you belong to the lies, that in his autobiography, Heartland. And in that long chapter, I think that what we are seeing is how so many, even people who were not directly involved with the Kennedy assassination on November 22nd of 63, how they have ended up belonging to the lie, as has the American public in general. So what I'd like to do, Jim and Paul, is to begin by unpacking the lies and the obstruction of justice. It is perhaps whipping the proverbial dead horse to speak about the Warren Commission and the things that they did. But bearing in mind, too, the operating concept of chokeholds, the legal ramifications or the legal strictures to which the evidence must adhere in order to constitute a chokehold. Starting with the Warren Commission itself and the things that they did to see to it that the public was not properly informed.
Go ahead, Paul. You wrote the chapter.
Well, thanks for the introduction. I wasn't sure if I could get it started. Yeah, the Warren Commission, I mean, from the get-go, was rigged. It was rigged from the start. It began with LBJ manipulating Warren, right, and telling Warren that if he didn't do his job, there would be a nuclear war. And, you know, indicating to him that, hey, look, right from the start, we have to go the lone nut road. And Warren did not want the position. He took it. Then they stacked the deck of the Warren Commission. Warren was very malleable, And who's he joined with? Two Kennedy haters, in McCloy and Dulles. One of them, Dulles, should have been really considered a suspect. I mean, maybe not, out of the starting blocks, but who the heck would hire someone like him after he was, you know, in so many words, let go by Kennedy because of the failed Bay of Pigs. So he comes in. And then, Gerald Ford is described by, Sullivan of the FBI as the FBI's inside man. And Hoover was very happy about that appointment. Those three, I think mostly McCloy and Dulles, are the ones that, nixed or Warren had a choice. I forget his name, Jim. Maybe was it Olson? He wanted as chief counsel, but it was, it ended up being McCloy and Dulles, I believe, who, forced him into taking Rankin. It was also a favorite of Hoover's. The next thing that happens is to get information from the intelligence agencies, right? Liaisons were appointed. So there was one appointed for the FBI, one appointed for the Secret Service, another one appointed for the CIA. One of the people for the CIA, John Witten, he had suspicions, you know, and even after the fact, he felt that J.M. Wave should have been investigated. He didn't know about the Cuban relationships with Oswald and their role in New Orleans. And he said, geez, if we needed information about them, we would have had that right out of J.M. Wave. But Helms replaced them. Replaced them by who? The number one loyalist that Dulles ever had, Angleton. Now, very interesting, I found this out late in the game, is the liaison for the FBI was a guy called Rocca. Ray Rocca, and the one for the Secret Service is a guy called Paul Paterni. All three of these people served on the OSS at the same time in Milan during World War II. So if you had combined those three liaisons with Hoover, Rankin, Dulles, Ford, LBJ, what you have is a control of the like-minded. And I think that played a huge role in controlling what would happen there on in. And you know, even though you had, as Jim, you put it, right, even at the end of the day, even though the Warren Commission ended up being a minority report, I think, Jim, you said that.
Yes, yes, that's true. Because we know today that Russell, Boggs, and Cooper did not buy the single bullet theory. All right, and we later knew from Giscard d'Estaing and Morris Wolf that Gerry Ford didn't buy it either. Okay, now the guy you're talking about was Warren only. Okay. That this only. This was Warren's first choice to be chief counsel. But, this was brilliantly opposed by Hoover, McCloy, and Dulles. All right. And for whatever reason, I think they thought only would be too independent. Okay. They decided to veto only and bring in J. Lee Rankin, who I think everybody knows essentially went along for the ride. Okay. He never, raised any objections. And in my opinion, he is one of the people who informed, Dulles and McCloy that Russell was going to bring up objections to the single bullet theory at the last meeting. And that's why I believe that last meeting, there is no transcript of that meeting. Okay. And Russell did not know this. There was a woman there who was obviously masquerading as a transcriber. So he assumed that all his objections, you know, were going to be recorded. Harold Weisberg alerted him years later that, you know, there's no transcript of that final executive session meeting.
Mm-hmm.
And he couldn't believe it. Russell couldn't believe it. He sent over his assistant to the National Archives. Okay. And a guy comes back and says, no, he's right. There is no transcript to that final executive. And this is what Russell started now in public, being the first guy on that commission to reject it. Okay. Yeah. Later, of course, in public, Cooper did for a BBC special. He said, no, I didn't buy the single bullet theory.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then Boggs was just violent in 19, I think before he passed away. Okay. He started calling J. Edgar Hoover a liar about everything. Okay. So if you add in Ford, it's really a minority report.
Yeah. And by the way, there was no bill issued by the stenographers for that last meeting.
That's correct.
Yeah.
So something else we might mention is that Hale Boggs' demise was not in bed quietly succumbing to any one of a number of natural disorders. He was killed in a plane crash in 1972, and for the longest time, perhaps even still, they have not been able to find that record. So his untimely exit was perhaps only too timely for certain interests.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The other thing that I think is demonstrated in that, because, you know, we cover all six investigations plus the breaking of the law by Trump and Biden in that chapter. But getting back to the Warren Commission, when it was evaluated by the church and the HSDA committees, they revealed just how biased the Warren Commission was. It's in those later investigations pointed out that on as early, can you believe this? As early as December 9th, 1963, Katzenbach wrote each member of the Warren Commission recommending that the commission issue a press release stating that there was no international conspiracy and that Oswald was a loner.
Right.
I mean, you know, this is insane. If you're going to have a press conference stating that, what are the next 8 months for? Sullivan, former assistant director in charge of the domestic intelligence division, he stated that on November 29th, 1963, the FBI had no data to support the conclusion that there was no foreign conspiracy. So what you're looking at, the fix was in. The fix was in. And Warren, what they tried to do is to, you know, avoid investigating. Even at first, Warren did not want the commission to employ its own investigators. He wanted to rely entirely on evidence produced by the FBI and Secret Service. There'd be no public hearings, no subpoena powers, no calling of witnesses by the commission, since it would retard rather than help our investigation. Now, of course, they didn't hold to that, but it shows you what the mindset was.
One of the things that is worth bringing in, I think, and that is the concept of networking. The term conspiracy, which obviously was put forward with emphasis by the agency as a good term for allowing the Warren Commission's critics to be discredited. But the term networking, I think, is not only more useful, but when we see people like Petrini and Angleton and Ray Rocha, and people even like Lyman Lemnitzer, who was the top military person involved with Operation Sunrise, puts Alan Dulles in with the same crew, and then Lenitzer is a fierce opponent of JFK's, and then they dust him off and bring him back for the Rockefeller Commission, which we'll talk about, headed up by none other than Gerald Ford. And so I think one of the things that we're looking at here is a network, and a network that is actively working to preserve itself by maintaining the lie. And that is what we're looking at here.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. It was a network for sure. And, the investigation by the CIA out of Miami, given that Oswald had interactions with the DRE, should have been really, really proactive, but they did nothing. Absolutely nothing. And they had way more manpower to look into that than the CIA did. So when you think of the CIA saying, hey, we're not even going to, I mean, the DRE, right, was being paid, funded by the CIA. They had George Ioannidis, who was in New Orleans for part of the time anyway, overseeing the DRE operations. So how you would have a situation where the CIA did not even look into that. And then, of course, there were the projects, AMLASH, the project to kill Castro. That wasn't even brought up. And the person who would have known about all this, of course, would have been Dulles, right?
Yes. So that's, you know, the one last thing about the Warren Commission, you know, they were completely stonewalled by the Secretary of the Interior down in Mexico, Echeverria, when they tried to investigate Oswald's alleged visits to the Soviet embassy and the Cuban embassy down there in Mexico City. They were not even allowed to interview Sylvia Duran, who was the person who had the most interaction with the alleged Oswald down there in Mexico City. Okay, she was the receptionist at the Cuban consulate. So here's my question. How on earth do you do an investigation, okay, of Oswald in Mexico City when you're not allowed to talk to anybody? Okay, so this is a very, very serious problem. And if you compare the Mexico City inquiry under the Warren Commission with what Danny Hardaway and Eddie Lopez did with the House Select Committee on Assassinations, I mean, it's night and day, all right? They talked to everybody and everybody down there, all right? And they really didn't have any limitations, you know, on their inquiry. And you learn a lot more, okay, than you do. Let's be plain and simple. The Warren Commission was a cover-up, okay, from the word go, all right? And it's taken us all these years, and we're still working on it, to try and undo the damage that the Warren Report did.
Oh, yeah. And you know, since we spoke about Dulles, think about this. Here's a key participant. He attends by far the most meetings, and the most interviews. He knows about CIA mafia plots to kill Castro. He knew George de Morenshield. He knew the Paines. He knew about the Mexico City operations. He knew about false defector programs. He knew about Fair Plea for Cuba Committee infiltration operations. He knew all about these relationships.
And he very likely knew who Oswald was.
Well, I, you know what, Jim? I'm pretty sure he knew who Clay Shaw was. I haven't gotten there yet. I wasn't in our book, but if you look at the whole Permindex, objective of manipulating European elections and the balance of power in certain countries there, how could he not have known about Clayshaw, is my opinion. And we do know Clayshaw knew the Cabells, right? Because the Cabells.
Because they spoke down there.
That's
and
right.
Shaw introduced Charles Cabell.
That's right.
Yes.
So think of everything this guy did to keep his colleagues in the dark, or didn't do, if you want. And then he's got Angleton, Rocca, and Paterni, you know, who are very cooperative liaisons and probably telling them, hey, look, keep this hidden. They're, you know, don't look into this. So he's probably manipulating and handling the investigation just as Ford is keeping Hoover abreast of everything going on. Alan Dulles is obviously working very closely with the CIA.
And by the way, the networking here, you've got Dulles and McCoy working all the way back to the immediate post-World War II occupation of Germany, where they're helping to basically inject Nazi war criminals and other Third Reich collaborators into our national security establishment. And you've got Gerald Ford, obviously a key Warren Commission member, and then he goes on to create the Rockefeller Commission when he becomes Nixon's vice president, and a lot of interesting people wind up networking there as well. We'll get to that. But one of the things that I think is important to keep in mind, and that is, Jim, when we were doing our 25 one-hour shows about Destiny Betrayed, we spoke about the synthesis of our media, the intelligence community, and the justice/law enforcement establishment. And as the Warren Commission and some of the key people involved with it were already obfuscating things. And by the way, we'll come back to George Ioannidis later on with the House Select Committee. But the media were functioning in a manner, I'm tending to say parallel, but it wasn't really parallel. They were part of it. If I could just briefly ask our two guests to speak about C.B. Jackson, his background in national security, his position of Life magazine, because as the Warren Commission was unloading what was basically a bunch of fiction, there were not only print media that were going amen and salam, salam, but then you've got Life magazine swiffing around the panels from the Fleas of Pruderfeld. Develop that for us, if you would.
Go ahead, Paul.
I'm sorry, Dave, I didn't get quite that final part of what you mentioned.
Well, you've got C.B. Jackson, who has a long history as a covert, well, I can't say covert op, as a national security operator, working with all kinds of people since the end of World War II. And then he is the fellow who secures the Zapruder film for Life magazine.
Yes.
And then Life magazine, run by Henry Luce, of course, whose idol, by the way, was Mussolini. But, when I remember as a kid, looking at the, I think it was September 1964 issue of Life magazine, of looking at the stills from the Zapruder film and not being able to make sense of them. And I just figured, well, you know, I'm just a freshman in high school, and what do I know? And these people are the big high muckamucks, and they wouldn't lie, blah, 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 blah. And there was a reason why I couldn't make head nor tail of it.
Oh, look. It's obvious. I mean, that was the smoking gun that had to be kept hidden. And, hidden to the point, I don't think there was ever any intention for that film to have been seen by anyone or as few people as possible. You can tell that because the Warren Commission has such a misleading description of the Zapruder film. Nowhere do you read in their description. Let me just read what the Warren Commission says about the Zapruder film. After a bullet penetrated President Kennedy's neck, a subsequent shot entered the back of his head and exited through the upper right portion of his skull. The Zapruder, Nixon, Munchmore films show the instant in the sequence when that bullet struck. And then they say, see exhibit 902. That impact was evident from the explosion of the president's brain tissues from the right side of his head. The immediately preceding frame from the Zapruder film shows the president slumped to his left, clutching at his throat, with his chin close to his chest and his head tilted forward at an angle. Based upon information provided by the doctors who conducted the autopsy, an artist's drawing depicted the path of the bullet through president's head, with his head being in the same approximate position. Do you see anywhere in that description the violent head movement that went back? I mean, so how can you show the Zapruder film after a description, or, you know, when that's the description you want to make of it?
And they saw the film over a dozen times. Okay.
Yeah.
They had the film. So it's not like they weren't aware of that tremendous left and backward movement. Okay. They just did not want to mention it in the report. Now, C.D. Jackson, not only was he a propaganda expert in World War II, he was a very good friend of Henry Luce. He wasn't just like, you know, a workaday fellow at Time Life. Okay. He was a close advisor to Henry Luce. And the icing on the cake on this is the article that was printed in Life magazine that actually said that Kennedy turned around towards a book depository, and that's how he got the wound in the neck. Okay. That is one of the most dishonest things that Time Life did a heck of a lot of dishonest things. Okay. But that is one of the most dishonest things that they did in trying to explain, you know, how Oswald could have hit Kennedy from the front, from behind. Okay. This, this is just incredible. And that whole issue of how Oswald could have hit Kennedy from the front, one of the very first things that got Mark Lane interested in the assassination was on the day of the assassination. Okay. The judge was in his quarters in his case, listening to the bulletins. Okay. And he called off the court for that day. And then as they were walking out, the judge said to Mark Lane, how could that guy have hit Kennedy from the front, from behind? And that's what started Mark Lane on his journey, you know, that ended up sweeping up there. So this is how terrible Time Life was. Okay. And then finally, when the cat is out of the bag, everybody listening to the show, I think, remembers when, or if you didn't remember, you can see it on YouTube, is when ABC, through the auspices of Geraldo Rivera, Dick Gregory, and Bob Groden, when they broadcast, I think that was in the spring of 1975, they broadcast for the first time the Zapruder film, okay? And it literally shocked America when they saw that thing. And so what does Time Life do? They sell it back to the Zapruder family for a dollar.
Oh.
I mean, that is the most sickening thing. You know, that's one of the most sickening things in this whole case. That they essentially, all they wanted to do was keep the Zapruder film from the public. That reveals it. They didn't want the public to see it. Okay, they had it bottled up for what? 12 years? Okay, at least 11. All right. And nobody was allowed to see it in the public. The only way you could see the Zapruder film, you had to go to Washington and go to the National Archives and watch the film. Okay. That's the only way you could have seen the Zapruder film at that time. And how many people were going to do that? It was just that club coterie, of dedicated researchers, you know, the Sylvia Mars, the Harold Weisbergs, You know, the Tink Thompsons. Okay. Those were the only people who were going to actually do that. And at that time, oh, I left out Vince Salandria. Okay. And at that time, how much reach should those people have? You know, and the answer is very little. So the public was in the dark about this explosive piece of evidence.
Well, Jim, if I can chime in, of course you had, Dan Rather, who gave a description. He says, I just saw the film. This is in and around the assassination. And he clearly says the head could be seen going violently forward, which is the opposite would happen. Now, Jim, you correct me if I'm wrong. In the Warren Commission, I mean, what we did see is reproductions of frames of the Zapruder film, but they changed the sequence.
That's true.
They changed the sequence of the frames.
Yeah, Hoover said it was a printing error.
It was a printing error. Yeah.
Okay.
Look, and by the way, we're talking about 60 years here. We're not even out of the Warren Commission.
Right.
There's so much more. I mean,
this is really out of the starting gate. All the damage that was done to the truth in this case. Okay. And it was almost, you know, as lawyers say, it was pretty much irreparable. Okay. Because you then had to make up for this lingering cover up that has really never gone away. I don't think it's ever gone away. And it was followed up, as Dave Emery said, you know, by the Rockefeller Commission. You know, now, if ever there was a rigged game, okay, if you have Gerald Ford as the president and you have David Belin as the chief counsel, how far are you going to get with those two guys? You know, that was a disgrace. And then he appoints people like Lemnitzer, okay, the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff under Kennedy, who he removed from office, okay, and Ronald Reagan with Nelson Rockefeller as the vice president running things, all right?
And by the way, Ronald Reagan as governor of California refused to honor Jim Garrison's extradition request for Edgar Eugene Bradley. So he previously had been part of what I really think is a concerted effort. Paul, you noted Dan Rather. And we have, you know, Life magazine basically throwing all of the panels of the Zapruder film up in the air and printing the ones that come down in the order they come down. I'm using a metaphor. But as we pointed out repeatedly in that 25 one-hour series about Destiny Betrayed, we depend for our information upon which to make intelligent decisions upon the performance of the media. And yet we see the media as active co-conspirators for the 60 years that Paul focused on and they continue to do that to this day. And we see some of these recurring characters like Gerald Ford, for example, Warren Commission member, then Nixon, who's in Dallas on November 22nd, 1963, said to the FBI, the only time I was in Dallas was 2 days prior to the assassination, which is a lie. And he appoints Gerald Ford of the Warren Commission to be vice president after, Spiro Agnew is ousted. And then Gerald Ford selects, Rockefeller Commission, which is just wild. You know, skipping ahead briefly, and I want to draw in as well what Richard Schweiker, as the Trip Committee began unpacking its information, and then on to the House Select Committee, where George Joannides once again reappears. But in the Rockefeller Commission itself, it may be that some of the younger members of the audience are going, oh, there goes Dave again. You've got Jim and Paul on, and they're talking about all that old stuff. This doesn't affect me. There was someone, and I did not know this until I read Chokehold's, there was someone who was selected by Gerald Ford, more about this whole team in a bit maybe, but that is a fellow named Dick Cheney. And that is a name that will certainly be familiar to younger listeners. He helped to direct American policy, well, really for a long time, but in particular under the George W. Bush administration. So Dick Cheney is in there editing away. So this, again, 60 years of obstruction of justice with a cast of thousands, so to speak.
And yeah. Yeah, well, Paul wrote about Dick Cheney in the book.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Dick Cheney. Well, what happened, that commission, as Jim was saying, was a joke. I mean, it was a joke from the get-go. You have Ford, you know, first of all, Ford and Rockefeller had their intelligence connections that we know of. We know that that Ford obviously was biased in this whole thing. I mean, how likely is he going to set something up that's going to destroy his own work, his Rock of Gibraltar, which he called the Warren Commission report? It's impossible to even fathom. So he brings in David Belin, who was one of the attorneys involved in the Warren Commission, to be the chief counsel. And then, you know, they relied that the things that Rockefeller himself did to, you know, the whole medical panel, the whole way that whole medical panel was set up to toe the line and to support the single bullet theory. And they completely misread the autopsy. The x-rays. They provided false information, and they misquoted Cyril Wecht. They even misquoted. They said that Cyril Wecht agreed that Kennedy was shot, killed by two shots from the back. Cyril Wecht went ballistic on that, and he absolutely, you know, said, I want to get the transcripts. I think he was recorded. I want to get the recording of this interview. And they had to wait 25 years, something like that, before he could finally get his hands on it, only to show that he was completely misquoted. Now, getting back to Dick Cheney, his job was to sanitize the report. I mean, that's what he was brought in for. You even had Kissinger come in to kibitz and to, you know, to give his orders. And you can see right away that, as with the Warren Commission, really the effort in this whole thing was image preservation. And that went with hiding the truth. And it was a very narrow investigation, because other than looking into the three tramps and some of the medical evidence, they didn't redo an investigation into the assassination. They certainly didn't correct all the errors of the Warren Commission. So, yeah, that was Dick Cheney's role. And it's funny, because wasn't it under Ford, Jim, that the you know, the neocons started taking
yes.
root, right? And
yes.
And that would have included Rumsfeld, right? And
Well, what happened under Ford was that it was the first burst forward of the neocon revolution, because they thought Kissinger was too liberal because he wanted a detente with the Soviet Union. So they stripped him of his national security advisor status. He had both national security advisor and secretary of state. And they ushered out Rockefeller. They did not want Rockefeller to serve another term because they thought he was too liberal on foreign policy. Okay. And so Cheney and Rumsfeld are usually given credit for the beginning of the whole neocon revolution that took over under Reagan.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, you talked, I think, Dave, about Richard Lindenberg, right? And
he was a former Luftwaffe scientist who was brought into the U.S. Brought into the U.S., under the auspices of Project Paperclip. And he's in there. And I didn't realize that Pierre Fink was also in that mix. Well, Pierre Fink also was called in on the Robert Kennedy assassination, according to Lisa Peace in A Lie Too Big to Fail. And, the presence, I think, of Richard Lindenberg is an example of what perhaps we could call, deep networking. Very, very quickly, Leon Jaworski, who was brought in by, Richard Nixon to replace Archibald Cox as Watergate special prosecutor. Archibald Cox had been JFK's Solicitor General, but, when World War II was going on, there was a case in Oklahoma at Camp Tonopah, I think it's pronounced, where German officers had been allowed to screen the mail of the other inmates at this POW camp. And one of them, a Corporal Kunz, was very anti-Nazi and opposed to Hitler, and he was murdered by those officers. When Leon Jaworski of the Judge Advocate General's office was placed in charge of the case, he didn't prosecute any of the American officers who allowed the German officers to screen the mail of and kill Corporal Kunz. The German officers were executed. That is perhaps the reason. This is pure speculation, but Jaworski was then selected to preside over the Dachau medical trials. And five of the doctors who had signed, who were in the defendant's dock at the Dachau trials, had already signed contracts to participate in Project Paperclip. And the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute of Aeromedical Medicine underwent a smooth transition from the regime of Adolf Hitler, in which the pictures of Goering and Hitler were on the wall. They were taken down. The pictures of Truman and Eisenhower were put back up. And then, of course, Leon Jaworski is part of the Texas Corporate Inquiry, and then he gets the Watergate Special Prosecutor. So perhaps Lindenberg and his presence on the Rockefeller Commission is not all that surprising. Maybe an example of what we could call, for lack of a better term, deep networking.
Well, see, he was part of the Russell Fisher nexus. See, Russell Fisher was a big wheel in pathology in the Baltimore area. And if you recall, Russell Fisher did the autopsy on Paisley, okay, who was a CIA counterintelligence officer who was suspected of being a double agent. And it's one of the most bizarre autopsies anybody's ever seen. You know, as Bud Fensterwald says, you know, it's a pretty odd thing for somebody to jump into the ocean, okay, and shoot himself under the water, okay, is a pretty odd way to commit suicide, okay. And Paisley's wife swore that this body that she saw was not Paisley, okay. All right, it's a very interesting case, but Fisher was the pathologist on that case. The CIA brought him in, okay, and so he was the guy who was running essentially the Rockefeller Commission medical thing, okay. And this is one of the things that Cyril Weck complained about. He said, these guys all came from the Russell Fisher clique, okay, down there in Baltimore, okay? And so this is what we're talking about, networking, okay, that this is the way these links, these deep state links, okay, how they run together, you know, in these cases.
And you see Richard Lindenberg himself, guy who wrote about this, and he gave a great presentation a year ago at Kappa, was author Russell Kent. He did a heck of a job on that. And he showed how all these specialists really came from Fisher. And that includes Richard Lindenberg. He wrote a paper for Fisher. And So, I mean, it really, when you look at the proper liaison, you know, if you're going to run and you're going to rake, a commission, you're going to call it, you know, an independent commission. But really, the key here is you're going to select the right specialist. And because there's no standard of proof, we talked to you about that. There's no opposition to anything you do. So whatever evidence or so-called evidence that was presented, you know, it was never contested, you know, whether it be for a chain of possession. It was never contested on the, you know, the quality of the evidence. So what you do is you get a bunch of third party endorsers that are specialists that, you know, will say what they'll say what you want them to say. And that's what they got out of Fisher. That's what they got out of Bellin. That's what they got out of Cheney. That's what they got out of Dulles. They got that out of Angleton, all the people. So yeah, network. And what's interesting, Dave, you alluded to this, is the network overlaps when you look at whether it be Watergate, RFK, Martin Luther King. The number of names that keep popping up and coming in as either a medical expert or as a lawyer. I mean, Jaworski, right? He was involved in a number of these scandals. And so, yeah, it is a network. These are fixers. These people are fixers. They're not, I mean, they may be specialists in, you know, under certain other auspices, but within this framework, these investigations, they're fixers.
Now, Paul does a very nice job on this in the book, and he wrote most of that chapter about the 60 years of obstruction of justice. I think Andrew had some input into that.
Yes.
Okay, Andrew Eiler. Okay, and he should have, because he's a lawyer, so he understands obstruction of justice. All right. And see, this is one of the things that we pointed to show that, look, can this really be a coincidence? Can it really be a coincidence that for 60 years and up until today, that the United States government does not want to reveal everything it has on the Kennedy assassination? Is it really a coincidence that the CIA launched operations against Jim Garrison? Is it really a coincidence that Ford appointed Lemnitzer and Reagan to the Rockefeller Commission? All right. Is it really a coincidence that the CIA did not want Sprague and Tannenbaum running the House Select Committee on Assassinations? Is it really a coincidence that even after the ARB, 25 years after which the law says everything has to be released, that here we are years later and we still don't have it? I mean, can all these things just be coincidences? I don't think so. And I don't think any objective person would believe that.
Well, yeah. And you know, this is what's interesting, is if you look, because what does happen in a case like this is inevitably not everybody will play ball with Dulles. Some people will try and do their jobs. We saw that with Russell. We saw that with Tannenbaum. We saw it with Sprague. What happens to them? They're replaced. So when Dan Hardway was doing great progress with Lopez, what do? They bring in a new liaison, Joannides. Joannides blocks everything. George Bush Sr. was brought in to kind of set things straight and protect the image of the CIA.
What do you mean, kind of? They didn't like what Colby was saying.
That's right.
Bill Colby was a CIA director, and they didn't like the fact that he was testifying openly about these assassination plots. Okay. And so he gets walked away. And they bring in Bush Sr.
By the way, Bush Sr. also was heavily networked with people like George Dimonshield, Ilya Mamontov, Jack Alston Creighton, I believe, was his opponent and for a congressional seat. He is part and parcel to this entire milieu. And so when he comes in, it isn't as an outsider. It is as an insider par excellence.
Right. Right. And one of the projects that he would not cooperate on, where he drew the line on, was Mockingbird. Okay. And if you take a look in both the Rockefeller Commission and the Church Committee, the sections on Mockingbird are very brief. In the Rockefeller report, I think it's only 4 pages. All right. It took Bernstein, Carl Bernstein, talking to the Rockefeller people and the church committee people to finally expose Mockingbird for Rolling Stone years later.
Correct. Oh, yeah. You see, this is what's interesting, is we see how the church committee and the HSCA describes how biased the Warren Commission was. But some of the same people, you know, when you're looking at, well, think of Tannenbaum. Tannenbaum, who's with the HSCA. Because there's one investigation we didn't talk about, but many people know about because of the movie JFK, is the Garrison investigation. And what does Tannenbaum reveal? Oh, yeah, we saw that his office was being wiretapped. Yeah, no, there was definitely a relationship between David Ferry and Oswald. He was saying quite clearly that Garrison, they kind of thought he may have been a bit of an oddball, but the more they looked into it, the more they saw that he was correct and on the right path. And yes. What we find out later is that Clay Shaw was, you know, despite his denials, a well-paid CIA asset. So.
No, he was more than that. He was a contract agent.
A contract agent, sorry.
Yeah, right.
But what do we get is you see someone who, ergo, this demolition campaign of Garrison. I mean, that's another. We have a big section on that, on just how much obstruction went on with the Garrison investigation.
One of the things you mentioned, and that in the movie JFK, something that I never realistically expected to see. I mean, to be seated in the movie theater and see a big screen motion picture, which for all of the areas in which Oliver Stone did take some artistic liberties, it's historically accurate, and to see the portrayal of what was done to Jim Garrison. But two things, we might want to touch on, but we've got maybe 6 or 7 minutes left in this show, and then we'll continue right into our next program. But in the movie JFK, there is a scene where Jean Larroquette, basically playing Johnny Carson on The Tonight Show, Big Six is Jim Garrison. That appearance was arranged, I believe, by Mort Saul, whom I alluded to earlier. Tell us about the Johnny Carson show. That goes into God knows how many, or used to, how many living rooms every night. And yet the media, that synthesis that we spoke about, Jim, in Destiny of the Betrayed, the media, the justice system, and the intelligence community all collaborating. And then they even got the old Tonight Show and Ed McMahon.
Well, what happened is that you're correct. The week before, Mort Saul, who was working for Garrison, turned to the crowd and said, how many of you would like to see Jim Garrison on The Tonight Show? And it was an overwhelming response. So Carson was backed into this thing. But see, he was working for NBC. Okay, and NBC had done the hatchet job on Garrison through Walter Sheridan in the summer of 1967. Okay. All right. And so the NBC was not going to give Jim Garrison an honest hearing. So they prepped Johnny. Okay. And Garrison talks about this in his book, as he has all these cards in front of him, which, you know, their NBC's lawyers had furnished him with. All right. And NBC says they don't have that show on video. Okay. But you can hear the audio. And it's really, really bad. Okay. It's very clear that they stuck Johnny with this role of being an opposing advocate to Garrison. The crowd wasn't going to learn anything. And so finally, Johnny says, well, why would Lyndon Johnson obstruct the flow of information on the Kennedy assassination? And Garrison says, looks at him, he pauses a beat and says, I don't know. Why don't you ask him, John? And the crowd went crazy. Okay. And so after the show, Mort was in the wings, and Carson was clearly embarrassed by what he had to do. And he said, you'll never be on this show again, Mort. And he wasn't until Jay Leno took over the show.
And by the way, NBC is not at all separate from General Electric, which makes the inertial guidance systems for ICBMs. They had Ronald Reagan on. I think it was GE Theater. So as a firm, they are, as a company, they are not at all separate from the institutional cover-up that is going on.
No, Dave, they were run by the Sarnoff family, okay? And the Sarnoff, David Sarnoff was in the Signal Corps, okay, for the government, you know, which is a form of intelligence. But they approved what Sheridan was doing there. We have the evidence now, okay, that they approved to go after Garrison with that hatchet job on NBC in the summer of 1967. Okay, it's in more than one book. So this is a direct connection to the power elite, you know, okaying this destruction of Garrison. And they were not going to let Garrison retrieve himself going on the Tonight Show. See, I think that was before Carson signed that huge contract. So he was still under their thumb at that time. Okay. And so that's why he did what he did.
Okay. And this might be an opportune time to wrap this program, and then we'll go right into our second program. Jim and Paul, tell the audience about your websites, about the book, about Black Op Radio, and where they can learn more.
Well, my website is kennedysandking.com. It's been operating for several years now. Paul is a contributor. All right. I'm a regular on Black Op Radio out of Vancouver. All right. And in addition to this, to JFK assassination chokeholds, I also was the screenwriter for Oliver Stone's film JFK Revisited. And there is a book supplement to that film, which I'm the author of.
Yes. So the JFK assassination chokeholds, you can buy in paperback or a digital version. You can, you know, you can go on Amazon and many other platforms to get it. We have a website called jfkchokeholds.com. So you can find out about the authors and the book if you go there. And, by going on the website, you can follow us on Facebook, and we're up to 146 followers, and we're getting more every day. And, so we'll answer your questions if you send us a question. And, I think you'll really, really enjoy the book. The book is designed for people who are beginners, to get an awful lot of out of it, just like those who've had an interest, like Dave and Jim and other researchers for a long time, in the way it's written. And so that's it. And don't hesitate to ask us any questions.
All righty, and we will be continuing with the 60 years of the Spartan of Justice, bringing back into focus Mrs. Joe Amidi's baby boy, George, whom we've already spoken of, and he comes back in a big way. Well, this concludes For the Record program number 1323, interview with Jim DiGiamio and Paul Blow about JFK assassination chokeholds. This is being recorded on March 8th, the year 2024. I'm Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.